It's Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs. Let's start the show with Lewis Tennant. Here we go. The guests and interviews that you're looking for, with creators, innovators, and so much more. For all episodes and further info, verbalhighs.com is the place to go.
All right, welcome to Dr. Tennant's Verbal Highs, a podcast podcasted weekly from a kitchen bench in Kingsland, Auckland, New Zealand, although this intro is coming live and direct from my workplace, as the landlord appears to be now full-time at Verbal Highs HQ, installing some Airbnb pods next door, so lots of sawing and banging and hammering 7 days a week. Lovely fellow, though, but hey, can't get in the way of progress. First up, before I get into talking about the guests, I would like to give a much more of an official shout out to the main corporate, that's a loaded word, isn't it? The main business supporter of the podcast. Had out of the blue an email, it must have been a month or two back now, from Dave at Hallertau saying, hey, can we send you some of our product? And I was like, heck yeah, and it turned up on the doorstep, and then some guests drunk some, and then we kind of gave little shout outs during the show, but I haven't sort of said officially a big thank you to Hallertau. They support a whole lot of, I guess, kind of independent projects like this around Auckland and around New Zealand. So much to my joy, another box turned up however many weeks later, and it was a big box of number twos. And we could run that gag out for the next 10 minutes, but the number twos were not, in fact, the sort that you jump on when they're in a paper bag, when you find them on the doorstep, but delicious number two pale ale of their 1-6 range. Great graphic design there, designed like die face, or dice face, the plural. And 1-6 are six different styles of Hallertau Brewery beer that you can actually buy in a box and have a taster of one, taster of two, taster of three, taster of four, taster of five, taster of six, and then maybe go off on a single number bender for the next time. So check those guys out. You can also go out and eat out at the brewery and listen to music and drink beer. One of our guests of yesterweeks, Mr. Paul Walsh, is wont to play records there every second Friday, I think. We can go to hallertau.co.nz. Right, Tim Murray, Mr. Kamek, a 40-year veteran, I realised, after he left, of the music scene. One of those doers, one of those kind of behind-the-sceneers, most well-known for founding Rip It Up magazine, which went for nearly as long as Murray's been around in the scene. He's also founded two seminal record labels, for those who don't know, are Southside and Wildside. We discuss a number of things around those labels and the people that were on them, most notably in the podcast anyway, Sheehard. We discuss the band itself and the doco, because I really wanted someone's perspective on the doco who was actually, quote-unquote, there, as it were, because it's hard to fit reality or unbridled what happened into 90 minutes, lest the fact that we all have different perspectives on reality. So Murray had a couple of quite funny, observations about that doco. Haven't talked politics. Oh, by the way, actually, another thing with Murray, I normally let the conversations speak for themselves. He's a huge love of photography, and he's been exhibiting his photos of late, and he's a huge love of soul music as well. I didn't quite get to cover the soul music avenue, but one thing I did want to discuss, and it's up on New Zealand on screen if you want to take a look, is he actually was behind a 1980s series that went through the history of soul music. If I'm not mistaken, talking about New Zealand artists, but talking about the wider soul music genre. God, good, those websites, eh? It's a bloody good resource, Old New Zealand on Screen. Haven't talked about politics, namely Trump, on the show for the last few weeks, which has been nice. But I saw a thing on John Oliver about Trump and net neutrality and Trump's level of understanding of net neutrality, and then it filled me with yet more existential fear. The internet, originally founded on very democratic, non-corporate principles, we need net neutrality. I'd say the environment thing with Trump worries me a lot more than the internet thing, but the internet is about all we've got left in this crazy world we live in now in terms of information. in terms of free flow of information and websites not being dictated, or internet speeds even being dictated by commercial influence. Okay, support and share the show, please. I heard it was amazing. I was listening to Rogan the other day. He gets more downloads than per week than a good, a highly rating mainstream media show like one on CBS, wherever in the States. So who says podcasts are underground? If my downloads compared to Rogan's, I wouldn't even measure on the wastage bit of the pie graph. I don't know, but I'm numbers are getting bigger. We're in little old New Zealand. Anyway, verbalhighs.com, Verbal Highs Podcast on Facebook, at Verbal Highs on Twitter. Feel free to drop me a note. Please like the show on iTunes if you subscribed on iTunes, or leave a comment on the site under an episode you've liked. And before I get to chatting with Murray, his exhibition AK 75-85, which is music-based photography, his exhibition starts on August the 1st at Black Asterix. If you're here in Auckland, that's the gallery on Ponsonby Road. All right, enjoy.
This is Dr. Tannen's Verbal Highs.
You can get under each other's...
Yeah. It's just people have to adapt. And like a friend who was showing me around a lot, one night I went to get the booking on my hotel, and the plain fact was it was just one night. I hadn't booked it. So I rang her up and said, can I stay with you? And she said, cool, fine. But the point was is that, you know, she's lived on her own for 10 years and can't fucking put up with people. You know, she's just in one of the... What do you call the one where, yours might be even called it.
Studio.
They
used to call them bedsits before they decided to give them a sexier name.
Yeah. But it's,
But what you went over to see some acts this time?
Yeah, but I also wanted, I'm a photographer, so the last 10 or so years I have been photographing sort of either Las Vegas, or I've tried to photograph the gentrification of changing downtown LA, but that was a total disaster this time because my friend sort of had...
You said a little bit of milk, so I...
Yeah, that's good. That's totally cool. It's perfect.
Great. Okay, bam.
I love coffee, and I'll probably regret it about midnight, but anyway.
Yeah. I'm drinking a lot of it lately. It's funny, I've sort of cut down to next to no booze, or a bit of booze, and then the coffee intake goes up. It's like I can't...
Yeah.
It's like I need something.
My problem is when I'm trying to...
do you want a water with you as well while we sit here?
A water might actually be quite a good idea in case my voice dries up, but when I'm trying to write, I tend to drink coffee as firstly just something. It can be helpful, but it's a distraction too. It's a way of, what's the word? It's not a distraction. It's procrastination. You know, it's It's a way.
Although I hear that, but also I am a first thing in the morning coffee, like jug on straight away.
Oh shit! Yeah. It's a very natural product, you know, the sort of stuff that you or I would drink in a plunger.
Yeah.
And it tends to have some good shit in it, I think, you know, but you can drink too much. Beer is a natural product with anti-cholesterol.
Yeah, a lot of these things are natural products that you can have too much of, you're right.
Yeah.
Well, should we just jump into it?
Yep, fine.
Did you listen to one today?
I didn't. Yeah, sorry. I had other frustrations today. Just it was the first day back, so I was sort of it's the first day where I got tried to sort out what invoices had been paid from beforehand, and you know who owed me money and hadn't paid, that sort of day, you know.
And what sort of things are you doing that you're invoicing people for these days? How are you?
Well, the main sort of work I do in a sort of creative sense, I mean, I'd like to think it was DJing, but I've been a bit light on DJing for about 3-4 months.
Yeah.
But the main creative work is writing in terms of earning income, plus the
photo- oh really so right yeah, so f- what audio culture
yeah just audio culture really yeah. But my problem is I'm very aware of what I don't know, so I tend to research too much and just spend too much time on something.
No, that's a good sign. That's almost like the academic approach to writing. I'm the same. Like I don't even know if you've come across my articles on audio culture, but they are, in terms of time to income ratio, they're a labor of love.
Yeah, you know? I've enjoyed some of your DJ ones, you know, yeah. and various ones.
The Benny Staples one's the latest one that's come out that I'm pretty happy with, and that's long.
Yeah.
But he's that kind of guy. It became... let's just say, and Benny's a dear friend, so I can say this. Let's just say attending to Benny was a large part of putting that article together, because he was really particular about.
Yeah.
You know, what a story. Anyway, we should say who you are.
Murray Kamik, and former editor of Rip It Up, and sort of a photographer by training, you know, at Elam School of Fine Arts, that sort of thing.
I've got it here. So this is the only bit of copy, mate. A journalist, photographer, magazine editor, record label founder, radio host, and DJ, as you say, perhaps best known for founding Rip It Up and also Southside and Wildside Records. Mm. Does that feel like a long time ago now?
Oh, hard to say. Rip It Up I sort of contributed to right to the end, really. Yeah. So, you know, to whenever it was, 2014 or whatever, I'm not sure.
Yeah, and you were... as you say, originally studying photography at Elam, but I read somewhere you were a school teacher for a time as well.
Well, I only did one day a week.
All right.
in 1978, I think, just the 1 year. Oh, no, 77 when Rip It Up started.
What were you teaching? Did you go to teacher's college?
Yes, I did, but I sort of went... Yes, I went to teachers' college, intended to teach, but when I couldn't get a job, we had already started Rip It Up during the teachers' college year, which would be 77, I guess. And so when I couldn't get a job, I applied for about three. I suddenly thought, well, I'll do Rip It Up for a while, you know.
And suddenly thought I'll do Rip It Up for a while. It's not like free press was sort of abounded in New Zealand. Where did the idea come from?
Well, we were definitely filling the gap left by Hotlicks, see? So we were not really a totally new idea.
Yeah.
The magazine Hotlicks had folded maybe a year before.
Was that a free music
paper? And it was a little... It was free until its last year. It got a cover price, and a friend of mine, Jeremy Templer, was the final editor.
Yeah.
And he basically went to do about a year's work on The Listener. And I sort of knew he was going to probably start a free magazine up. And then we heard Hugh Lynn was interested. So me and my friend Alistair Dougal, we sort of pushed in ahead of those other two.
And how old were you then?
Well, I was not that young, because I'd done university. Yeah. And I'd done a year on Crackham and a year student teacher.
21, 22-ish?
So, no, I'd be about 23, I think.
Yeah. Still quite young to launch such an endeavour, and what did it involve in the 1970s? It's perhaps a few more hurdles and stumbling blocks than now.
Yeah, it wasn't like to print the first Rip It Up. I remember the bill was about $500, which would be, you know, that's quite a bit of money probably in those days, but, you know, later on printing Rip It Up was, when it was free and being given away, was more like, you know, near 10,000, I think. You know.
Did you start off charging for it before it went free?
No, we were definitely free right at the beginning. Yeah. But the magazine before us, Hotlicks, had a cover price on in their last year.
Right.
But they didn't collapse because of their cover price necessarily. They collapsed because they were part of the... a part of a record chain that went down, the Direction Records group.
Yeah. So you guys probably had more, probably had a, a freer, I guess, template in front of you, that you didn't have a big company behind you in terms of what you write about and how you approached it? And did they just appear in kind of one suburb initially, or were they New Zealand wide?
Oh, they were New Zealand wide, because New Zealand is a small place. So yeah. it was very easy just to get a list of the main record shops. And so we immediately did, I think it was 7,500 copies. And a lot of the distribution was by rail, which, you know, was government control of the freight industry then. And it didn't cost you much to send a massive pile of 200 rip-it-ups to the biggish stores in Christchurch, Dunedin, Wellington, etc. And then you soon found you were, you know, going to some store in Coromandel because people were growing dope there, or...
What's the connection there?
Well, it's just that you ended up in these suburban, you know, you ended up in these rural places just because there were young people there.
Oh, right. And this is a sort of thing where, limited media environment back then compared to now, you know, arguably less competition just for people's brainwaves. And was it a matter of them appearing in places like record shops and stuff and just being picked up without doing an ad campaign and stuff? I'd imagine they promoted themselves, wouldn't they?
Yeah, there was absolutely no need for an ad campaign. There was such a demand for it. There were some people that were disappointed that we were a bit low rent looking compared with Hot Licks.
Yeah.
Hot Licks had better designers, certainly when they were selling, and they just had a more sophisticated look, and we were a bit rough and ready. And the punk.
Hey, yeah, I was going to say the punk era was the right era for it, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And so, thinking about it going into it, you know, you weren't young, you weren't green, like us was 17 or 18 or whatever. But at the same time, you know, I think it's a big undertaking. What do you reckon that you had sus from the beginning, and what was more like, I have no fucking idea what I'm doing?
Well, we were a little green in the sense that we thought, you know, we could largely write about the people we liked.
Yeah.
And we did get to do that a bit. But media tends to reflect the audience and obviously the flow of music and stuff. And even though we were very pro black music and soul and stuff, there wasn't much filtering through, really. We put the Commodores on the cover of the first issue. But what was happening was the punk new wave thing, so we followed the punk new wave thing. But we were Thin Lizzy fans and Bruce Springsteen fans and David Bowie fans, so we did like the good stuff from the old school.
I don't want to say words in your mouth, but you kind of saying that of that era, because I know you've got a long attachment to soul music, which we'll get to later on. You know, New Zealand, at least the media side of New Zealand was arguably kind of whiter. Was it you found it harder to have diversity of content then? Is that what you're meaning, or was it just...
Well, we could put, say, Mark Williams, the local guy, on our second cover, sharing a cover, I think, with Joe Cocker, and we could put Tina Turner on about issue 8 because we were sort of soul fans. But you do... Media does reflect its audience more than impose on its audience, you know.
Yeah.
And we also entered a strange time where the local new wave sort of punk scene, they couldn't get records out initially. And then things like AK-79 was basically a collection of demos, which disappointed me. I thought these people should have good quality studio recordings. And the local sort of big powerhouse in local recording was HMV in Wellington, which by then was probably changing its name to EMI, but they closed their studio, and you know, and then the pressing plant closed. So that was more like mid-80s, I think, the pressing plant closed. But these changes did come upon us, you know, and we don't control any of those.
And then what did you as I say, what did you have to learn to do through error and error at the beginning?
Well, we had to learn to sell ads.
Yeah.
And we had to learn the idea that the customers are always right, in a way. And we had to learn to discount ads.
What's the second one? I'm curious about that. The customers are always right. So what does that mean about the readers? How are they always right?
Well, what I mean by the customers always right in terms of, I really meant the advertisers, in the sense that, you've got to please them in the sense of if they buy a page and they want a quarter page free as a bonus, well, you just sort of have to accept that. Or if you think you agreed on a certain rate for that prime position and they say, no, we agreed on this rate, you have to just take the customer's memory. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You just have to... if it wasn't written down at the time, you know, because we never had an advertising contract, I don't think right to my last days of publishing it, you know, right through to 1994, everything was verbal.
So you just had businesses that sort of, like, were hopefully reasonably kindred spirits and no one kind of took the piss and took advantage of that.
Yeah, and sometimes people got upset by us, and I recall...
What did you do to upset them, Murray?
Well, Mike Chun did a really bad review of London Town by the Paul McCartney, and he's a big Beatles fan, and of course he's a big fan of Paul McCartney as a bass player too. He's in a similar vein, style, and I was called down to EMI to meet them because I think we'd had trouble. They certainly didn't advertise in the first year, and neither did PolyGram, though PolyGram said they wouldn't advertise, and EMI said, oh, we'll have three pages every issue. And when people start things, they've got to realize that some people make stupid promises, you know.
Yeah.
You've got to be aware of the, you know, the person who says that they'll support you fervently when they don't. I was asked down to EMIC to meet them after I'd done my teaching section, on a teaching session out at Linfield College. And after, on my way there, I went to CBS, and they got the new Rolling Stone, and Bob Dylan had played Western Springs, and they'd use my photo of Bob Dylan, you know, and like for a photographer to be in Rolling Stone is just like, you know,
Holy Grail.
Gone to heaven.
Holy Grail.
And my very low, at times I have low self-esteem and relatively low ego, but I have a photo in Rolling Stone, so I go straight to EMI.
Balls to the wall.
Yeah, and they say, well, you know, we've had these retailers and say, phone us and say, how can you let that little magazine write a bad review about your record, and you're a big record company, see? So they'd basically been told that it was time for them to bully me. And I just was saying, oh, well, Phil Manzanera says Mike Chun's a really good bass player and da-di-da-di-da. And I was not very helpful. But anyway, I stood up for our review, you know, mainly because I just was on ego tripping, you know.
How have you dealt with it over the years? Because I noticed that probably our most prominent, one of our most prominent reviewers now is Simon Sweetman, at least in my Facebook feed and so on, and he cops a lot of flack, and I don't agree with all of what he says, but he's a reviewer and I see that as his role. Like, what's your thoughts on all of that, the role of the reviewer over the years? Is there a line that can be crossed, or is it all fair and love and war, you know?
Yeah, well, I think people can, you know, we have freedom of speech, and at some point we decide something is hate speech, and then we don't have that freedom. So I accept, you know, Simon's views, but at times
I'm not honing in on Simon in particular, but he really brings up this question of the role of the reviewer, and I think a lot of people confuse that as audience members, you know.
It's everybody's got different view. Like, I like the word reviewer.
Yeah.
I hate the word critic, which, you know, critic is the one used in New York for the people who review Broadway shows.
Yeah.
And they're generally stuffy old men with big egos.
The two old guys from the Muppets, that's what I...
Yeah, they've got the look. So I don't like the word critic, because it's like you're not going to something to criticize it, you're going to something to report on it, you know, or review it.
I never thought about that. That's a really interesting fight. Yeah, those two words are very different.
Yeah, but some people like Graham Reed believes in the word critic. I just don't myself, and I'm a sort of, you know, I like to use the word writer, but
so Rip It Up was full of reviewers reviewing.
Yeah, but yeah. I mean, we usually only had about 200 words per album.
Yeah.
And sometimes if it was special, we'd let people go to 400. So we really weren't in for sort of people grandstanding, or we occasionally in live reviews and that. I'm just trying to think if we had much sort of, what do they call that, train of consciousness or?
Oh, stream of consciousness?
Stream of consciousness. Yeah. Well, or that sort of writing. We didn't have much of that in the sense that we were reasonably structured and stuff, you know. But occasionally in features we would let writers be sort of more creative in terms of their style.
More creative in terms. I mean, that's because the reason I giggle at that is, if someone is, let's say, a dab ham with the pen, and they can totally crack me up while they're cutting something down. I do find critique, I guess, quite funny. Who at Rip It Up was kind of particularly good at that, like being very clever with their turns of phrase as they tore the walls down.
There was a guy, Matthew Highland, who came to us on work experience, and it was Russell Brown who encouraged him to write. You know, Russell said to me, this guy can write, you know, so I mean, it's no use him just sitting on the couch doing nothing. We'll get him to write.
The couch at Rip It Up or the couch at home?
Couch at Rip It Up.
Yeah.
So Matthew Highland had some really funny lines, and he did a very sort of negative review of Hallelujah Picasso's that I think they would have even loved. It was so funny.
Yeah.
And he said things like, you know, if a member of the band approaches you with their free demo tape, you know, tell your mother or call the police, you know. Stuff like that. There's a whole series of those statements that were a lot funnier than what I said.
I was just thinking of, like, someone like Stinky Jim's kind of, it's sort of like an angry reggae Dr. Seuss in the way he sort of his kind of turns of phrases and so on. So the 70s, if that was just the last 3 years for you guys with that magazine, but if you could sum up that first 3 years and the end of that decade, what was featuring in Rip It Up? You mentioned the punk scene emerging. What was the late 70s?
Well, I'm obviously a soul guy, and with soul I had the choice of Gladys Knight singing Wind Beneath My Wings or disco, you know. And, of course, disco was what was exciting in the soul area. But our magazine, even though I really liked disco, we hardly covered it. We did a feature that I thought was really sort of Ivory Tower, and I really disliked that. And that was
What do you mean by Ivory Tower? That's not a phrase I'm...
Well, Ivory Tower, I meant it was sort of... One criticism you could have of Rip It Up initially was if you lined up the riders, they were all male initially, because they were people we just grabbed. Most of us lived in the eastern suburbs, St. Helier's. Some went to St. Ken's, some went to Auckland Grammar. I went to Glendale College. But we were just so eastern suburbs, white, male.
I got it. I get
that's
it.
That's what we were. I mean, we added people, you know, like people from Dunedin who were really good on New Zealand music, and we slowly added some women writers, and we got people who, you know, worked in Radio I Newsroom, like Duncan Campbell and Ken Williams. So the point was, we were quite narrow at that
time. And so with the disco thing and the Ivory Tower, how does that relate?
Well, the Ivory Tower is what everybody went to Auckland University. We all had degrees.
Ivory Tower,
see?
Ivory Tower,
so, it wasn't really a very...
It didn't scream gay, black New York, that disco article.
No, well, I think none of us could dance, you know?
Well, the funny thing with disco, I think the funny thing with disco is it's interesting that you wrote an article back then, because I was two or three, Murray, but looking back on it, my take on the whole disco thing is it was really maligned in terms of the pretty much the worst end of it ended up in the charts, right? So
oh, well,
I don't
I
know if a lot of that really. Oh no, no, I mean some of it's great. Some of it's great pop music. Don't get me wrong, but I wonder how deep into disco music New Zealand really was back then. We probably got more people who know about underground disco now.
Yeah, but there was a lot of tracks were just so big, and there were the clubs. But I had just also come through a bit of a born-again Christian thing, so I didn't even drink. Yeah, I was a born-again Christian when I started ripping
up.
But I was also into music and photography, and, of course, I wanted to print my photos, so...
There goes my question on unbridled hedonism in the first years of the magazine.
Well, I didn't drink. I came from a non-drinking family.
Right.
Even though they were not, they weren't sort of what you'd call fundamentalist Christians, which is what
was
I embraced.
Was it? I mean, look, I grew up with a grandmother that took me to church on Sundays, but I wouldn't say we were a particularly religious family. Was it something along those lines? Like the church was present, but...
I think the
So you didn't lose God and then find him again later in life?
No. I just went heavy on God in my teen years for whatever reason. And it wasn't... my parents didn't sort of just let me go the way I went. You know, I was obviously trying to convert them, you know, to be the sort of tedious Christian I was. But eventually it did disappear or, you know... phased out of my life. And the other thing
I wouldn't have asked. I was going to say, you don't talk about religion or politics, do you? But I was wondering where that was now, whether there was the occasional duck into the Sunday service. No, you just...
Oh, well, I just lost interest. Maybe 3 years into Rip It Up, I started to lose interest in Christianity a little bit. But the main point at which I really lost interest was when the fundamentalist right-wing American Tea Party and all that bigotry... took over.
That's right. The hate people took over the love vibe.
Yeah, well, it was all love and peace to me. It was all a bit hippie.
I'd run to disco too if it was between between that and the right wing. So to the 80s, we've got content-wise, musically-wise, what really sticks out is what sums up the 80s music and culture-wise channeled through Rip It Up to New Zealand.
Well, there's this... weird situation where in my memory a lot of things that I think are early 80s like ska and
I'd say ska.
Yeah, but a lot of things like what's the British label that had the Specials and all that on? Two-Tone.
See,
all that Two-Tone nearly and the Jam and Mod and a lot of that stuff I associate with early 80s is actually all... is 79. There is a tendency for big things to happen at the end of a decade, just like Woodstock sat at the end of a decade.
But then again, you were there, I was there, but not really there because of my age. But wasn't it back then also that, I mean, I'm thinking things like even just some of those bands airing on the Young Ones and stuff, like, didn't things just take a few years to get, you know, not you hip connected people who are running magazines and so on, but maybe ska was a early 80s thing in New Zealand compared to a late 70s thing in England.
Yeah, but at the time there was... I don't necessarily know what commercial radio was always doing because there was a whole youth culture based around, you know, what Rip It Up was writing about, what the local record store was talking about and what Radio Pictures was showing the video for.
Yeah.
It's like...
And the media triptych was that. That's right. It was just Radio with Pictures.
Simple, really.
I didn't want to say simple, but that much less cluttered than today.
Yeah, so if I come into work on Monday morning and I talking to the designer, John Pitkin, or any of the people, you'd just say, oh, what did you think of the Cure clip or whatever?
Yeah, yeah.
Because we all saw it the night before, and everyone into music saw it.
Yeah.
You just did, and
it's where I started to like know there was other stuff other than what was on ZM, and then finding out it was some, I don't know about up here, Murray, but it was back in the day. One of Radioactive's claims to fame was it was one of the really early FM stations, and so TV Radio with Pictures was simulcast through active. So beautiful stereo sound. I mean, it sounds like, I mean, everyone's got that set up now, don't they?
Yeah.
But that was the appeal, and I just saw a whole lot of stuff that...
And you would know how important, like, student radio was, you know. And we would do these ads for student radio to make it look really organized, and, you know, some stations would just be on in the summer break, and then at one stage BFM was on for the breakfast session, went silent at 10, and then came back on maybe 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah.
And it sounds stupid now, or...
I don't think it sounds stupid. It's just basic's not the right word. Simple. There was just less.
Yeah, it was just a lovely... It was just those early days of... student radio around 83. I started Land of the Good Groove 84, I think, or possibly 83, but Duncan Campbell and Nigel Horrocks were already around. Duncan was doing the reggae show and Nigel Horrocks was doing a jazz show.
And so the 80s, we're going to sum it up, we're going to be very reductive. So we had ska, what else? New Wave?
Well, ska was right at the beginning. New Wave's virtually all those... Big things are really all 79-ish, you know. Yeah.
What sums up the 80s for you then?
Well, the 80s is probably Wham.
We
put them on the cover.
Yeah.
You know, the new romantic thing, and then that went through to Britpop, didn't it? Or was Britpop 90s?
90s.
Well, we were... I have said to
Culture
people...
Club. Never really realised they were kind of a reggae band.
Yeah, well, they had their good moments, but that 80s was...
hip-hop later on?
Yeah, of course the hip-hop's coming through, and hardcore's coming through too, isn't it?
What do you mean by hardcore? Like, hard, is it Rollins, guitar? Like, hard, yeah, right, I right. Think. So that's, yeah, that sounds like a
the
late
American
80s thing.
Scene.
Yeah, but Husker like, Du.
Yeah, and obviously... The dominant thing for us is, of course, the emergence of New Zealand music in the 80s. And everyone from sort of Sharon O'Neill, Dave Dobbin, Flying Nun, there was just herbs. There was a real richness.
Yeah.
And I recall, like...
Of course, yeah.
The other thing about me as an editor, sometimes, you know, I'm a little removed. Like, I had my first midlife crisis when Joy Division came along, and... I was about 26 or something, and I just was like, what the fuck, you know, I just hated it, and so I employed a young guy, Mark Phillips.
Why did you hate Joy Division?
I'm just a bit of a shallow bucket, you know, yeah. I mean, you know, I've got a sort of, you know, 70 cent fresh bread roll and butter, and I'm in heaven, you know? I'm just sort of not really, sort of, there's no place in my life for Joy Division. So I hired a young person, and...
At 26, you hired a young person.
Yeah, and by the way, I told Dolph from the Datsuns that my first midlife crisis was at 26, and he said, me too. So I'm not the only one.
No.
I think there was a point to that.
Yeah. Okay, so we'll go to the 90s. What sums up the, you know, again, reductive, a whole decade, what sums up the 90s in
I think I've got
music
to my, I've worked out my point. Is I was just writing fads as an editor. There would just be one fad after another. It was so easy, you know.
Yeah.
It was so easy to... there was big cover artists, and then, of course, grunge is what was... the 90s for me, because I'd started Wildside and I was doing Head Like a Hole and She Had and Dead Flowers and stuff.
Yeah.
But we would put an endless repetition of Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, etc. on the cover, Nirvana and stuff. And even though we did put Stone Roses on the cover, I never really got them into them till about 2010.
Right, yeah. So what happens, like, you know, you had a big grin on your face as you said, I fucking hate Joy Division, but,
yeah.
You know, how democratic were you as an editor? Like, was there some artists where you just had to put your foot down and say, look, this is not going into the magazine?
You can't do that. Yeah, no, see, the thing is that, like, I had staff writers, Russell Brown and John Russell, and if you interviewed them, they would call themselves assistant editors. Now, they were called staff writers, but in truth, they were assistant editors, because I let them decide. And with Russell, I sometimes would say, well, you know, I don't even want to know who this kind of punishment is, but if creatively you want to write 2,500 words,
this punishment.
I will try and fit it in, you know. And he always respected the fact at least one story a month I'd sort of let him do whatever he wanted to do. And he was the backbone behind our Flying Nun coverage, you know.
So you had a socialist approach to running the rag, yeah.
Yeah, but and at one point in the 80s, I got Chris Birkin as editor, and in our agreement, I had the final say on covers. But in the end, when he wanted Ziggy Marley and I wanted Sinead O'Connor, I got very angry about it, but kept Ziggy because he wanted Ziggy Marley. But as a photographer, of course, our photos of Sinead O'Connor were just beautiful, and you want them on the cover, so we didn't end up with her on the cover.
So your first love, from what I've read and what you sort of said when you came in, is photography. Was that a very welcome byproduct of being editor of a magazine, getting you know, press passes to be up the front taking photos of large shows and so on?
It was in the early days, yeah. But as we progressed, I found that if I was taking, say, a photo in the afternoon, it would preoccupy me a bit during the day. So yeah. In the end, we just were really lucky to have a bunch of young photographers, Kerry Brown and
So you sort of bit your tongue and didn't end up going out and...
A lot of other people tended to do the photos. And we also, at one point, I ended up doing the fashion magazine Cha-Cha, and that caused... Nyla Dixon was the editor, and she just attracted great photographers, you know. And she... Yeah. I know at one point, Daryl Ward turns up with some photos in a school uniform, and I'm thinking... Isn't this sort of a bit young, you know? I mean, where will this end? Yeah. And, of course, he was fantastic, and he's a lovely person, yeah. Daryl Ward. And both him and Kerry Brown have been great. But there's Chris Major. There's just so many photographers, you know.
Photographers, writers, I mean, it launched a lot. Well, at least was a big part of the assist in launching a lot of careers. So what was the criteria for recognizing potential other than reading it and going, well, that person can write? Was there any other,
when John Russell took over Real Groove, yeah. And I left the Rip It Up editorship, I was a bit titty, and I've told him about this. I was a bit pissed off.
When who took over, sorry?
John Russell left. We were all fired in 94.
You were fired from your own magazine.
Fired from Rip It Up because by that stage I didn't own it in 1998. I didn't own it after 1994, and in 1998 the staff we had were let go by Barry Coleman. We were owned for that 4 years by National Business Review.
Right. Yeah.
And because he was sort of briefly trying to expand his sort of magazine empire. And Rip It Up wasn't doing that well at that stage. But John went to Real Groove and used most of the Rip It Up writers. And I thought that would have been an opportunity for him to find new writers. But, I mean, he said to this day about the only great new writer he found in that time was Duncan Grieve.
Yeah.
He actually said he had trouble finding new writers. But the comparison I make is sort of if Rip It Up's... almost the only act in the country with opportunity for music writers, chances are it will attract talent.
Yeah.
And there was a point where we're just saying no to people and they were offended because we had enough people. But
surely there's a lot of people who romantically want to be music writers who are just chances. You must have known to sort the wheat from the chaff.
Yeah, it's situations where... like Paul McKesser, who's you know worked in management and Flying Nun, he asked to interview me, and he was at Hamilton Boys High or something, and he came along, and after he did that interview, I never said no to any more interviews afterwards, because he just, we found a great writer in Paul.
Yeah.
And what happened was, I was, I'm not sure how old I was by then, but I was feeling a bit jaded and tired. And
27, second midlife 30 crisis.
Something. So I started answering his questions with shorter and shorter answers, and he always had another question, and I'm just sitting there thinking, I remember when I always had another question. I remember those days. And see, we got him as a young writer, and Paul McKessar was great.
Yeah.
And he became friends with Russell Brown, and, you know, in the end, Paul was running Flying Nun for a while, I think.
What do you reckon, is it harder or easier these days for the for 2017's equivalent of these names you're reeling off? You know, how does one forge a path now?
I'm just not so sure. Obviously, it's sad one doesn't have, you know, a magazine like, you could never have Rip It Up Again existing in an environment where there was no internet and there was no music TV and no...
Murray, there's no record shops to pick it up from anymore.
I know. That's the problem.
14,000 copies in Real Groove, in Real Groovy.
Yeah, and there's, like, I thought that Fold magazine was a good gig guide.
Yeah.
And I would see it sit and not be picked up. Whereas it fitted in your pocket.
Yeah.
Why would a, you know...
I just guessed on the on the cusp of that digital change, yeah. Because, well, I always used to pick up the Wellington equivalent 10 years earlier, which was called Engine.
I just, you know, I just couldn't believe when people wouldn't pick that up. And there's another other magazine at the moment that are quite good. Like, I thought the first issue of Paperboy was appalling, but
yeah,
there's been a few issues in the last... in May, April, May, that were just excellent.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not a vegetarian, but there was this 3 pages on vegetarian restaurants and the views of some of the owners, and that was just fantastic.
Oh, this is terrible. I've not even heard of, I think rings a bell, Paperboy, but I didn't hear, is it for sale? In
it's
the
free. It's free. Okay. And, like, it's just so annoying that people don't know about and pick it up.
Well, there you go. I would have known about it 15 years ago.
Yeah, the Ponsonby Food Hall has a place where you can pick it up.
Yeah.
And I know I live over the shore, and the stations for the... North Shore Express bus all have places where you can pick it up, and I think there's one outside a wine shop in Ponsonby Road.
I'll keep my eye. It definitely rings a bell. Barker's fund a free magazine, and then
what have Barker's got?
Someone else brought it up in another podcast. They fund a magazine that actually does reasonably good long form articles. I can't remember what it's called. It's called 1974 or 1972.
I must look for that. Yeah.
Maybe going to a Barker's. The Vice still have a physical copy floating on about. They're an interesting story in themselves. But
yeah.
So 90s. I want to get
grunge.
On to, well, not grunge. Nope. Sorry. Southside and Wildside.
Oh yeah.
Arguably very different flavors label wise. So it sounds like you decided to get a bunch of emerging Pacifica artists, hip hop artists onto a label. So how did that come about, for the love of soul music from the magazine?
Well, I had observed my friends like Trevor Reiki and Roger Shepherd and them all struggle with record labels, and I just thought it was a loser's game.
Yeah.
And then Simon Lynch, who was... he wasn't flatting there. Yeah, he was flatting there by in Ponce, but he came round with this track by D-Faction, and Simon Lynch and Tony T had come out of Artie Jar, and I just decided I would release it myself and got a deal with Festival. So my ego suddenly decided that I could, you know, choose the hits better than other people. And of course, I had some successes, but I had, you know, disasters too, you know, in terms of losing money, you know. And what we did, Southside first, and then when we had a bit of success, like Nairi number one for 6 weeks, and
What was the tune?
To Sue with Love.
To Sue with Love,
yeah,
of course,
and then
yeah.
Number two with another cover version, Moana's Black Pearl, and then a couple of cover versions by Defaction did top 10 or did gold records. But what we found is that the producers then started charging us too much for per track. You know, they wanted $2,000 per
track.
The
people who had the songwriting credits.
The producers, they weren't necessarily songwriters, but producers sometimes.
The studio producers.
People like Mark Tierney and them wanted more money than we could afford.
Yeah.
And then Gerald Dwyer just rang me up and said, we're going to put Head Like a Hole in the studio. It's going to cost $4,000 or something. If you put in, you know, $2,500 or something, you can have it. And
LP. So Gerald stays managing, but you are the record label.
And then we got the first She Had album for $5,000.
Yeah.
See, so
what are you? But this, what's this cost? This amount of money about? What is this? That means that you can have them on your label.
Yeah. Well, the $5,000 was the cost of the studio recording to us.
Yeah.
And in the case of Head Like a Hole, the cost of the studio recording was, I think, $2,500. Well, that's better than paying $2,500 for one dance track. You need 10 to make an album.
Yeah. And so for your X amount of money, you get a percentage of sales as the record company.
Yeah.
And then the songwriters get their money. And
the distributors in those days would be taking the bulk, but the distributors would be paying for the manufacturer.
Distributors. And the manager then just steps back and manages.
The manager is just getting, 20% of 1,000 kids at the power station.
Now, I don't want to, again, put words into your mouth, because I do a bit of reading and just my own knowledge before people come over, so I'm not a complete disaster. Mm. I heard that you saw a particular talent in She-Hat,
Yes, but...
Which is totally understandable.
Yes, but She-Hat had already had a hit EP on... Pagan.
You don't strike me as a thrash metal guy, though. That first EP was thrash.
Oh, no, I wouldn't have liked that at all. But the point was, the new album that I got to hear was a better... was
Churn?
A more interesting. No. Churn, Churn was more interesting and more unique. It certainly wasn't...
It wasn't derivative of what they've been listening
to. It wasn't like them trying to be another band as the EP was. And the situation was is that they had paid for that first EP... so they'd finance themselves, and when they came to do the first LP, Pagan didn't want to put any money in. Then we offered $5,000, then Pagan matched it, and Sonny was sort of interested but decided no. So it ended up on Wildside,
Churn did.
Yeah.
And I'd imagine, not that you would have been in it for these reasons, but at the same time you don't want to be losing money, but I'd imagine you made a return on your investment and then some with an album like Churn.
Oh, yeah, we would. And then money would go into Killjoy and that. But I tended to waste a lot of money on promotion. So I was never very good at making anything profitable. But
at least you had a magazine to put some free ads in.
Yeah, we got free ads in the magazine. So, of course, the magazine, in a sense, there was different things I was doing that got damaged by... my, paying for recording bills sometimes.
Oh, hindsight's 20/20. Yeah. You do what you do in the moment, don't you? And through all of this, are you working directly with the bands? Did you get to know, like, the She-Hat Boys and those, the people you're working with?
Oh, definitely. Well? You did, we did them in Australia too via festivals.
Yeah.
So sometimes, I'd be the only one in Australia and Gerald wasn't always there. When they toured, obviously, he was there.
Do you mean you were going over with them? So you're almost
to do
a tour
promo.
Manager.
That would be to do promotional interviews and stuff like that.
Yeah.
If they were there to play live, their manager would be there.
I see. So you're sort of getting them around to interviews and stuff. And sounds like exciting times. So it sounds like one of the biggest, ultimately the biggest acts on both labels in terms of what you were doing with them.
Yeah, and it was just... it was just so much fun, both Head Like a Hole and She Had, because you may be the record company, but when there's 1,000 kids just totally enjoying themselves and Mosh Pit and
they're amazing shows,
fun,
right? Amazing shows.
It was just it was just how could you not enjoy yourself, And that energy would keep you alive. And I thought that the same with when Propeller Records was big for a while in the 80s with Screaming Memes at Main Street and that.
Pneumatics and all those bands.
Yeah,
yeah.
The excitement of those live gigs would almost pump me up psychologically to keep on losing money on Rip Club. You know? You know, it was...
So what did you think of... Do you know, by the way, there's a there's a Head Like a Hole doco coming out soon? Because they've made a bit of a resurgence. And I'm really looking forward to seeing it. Booger's wife, Tamsin, posted about it recently.
Yeah.
What did you think of the Shi'ar documentary? It must have been quite a thing to watch.
Well, I enjoyed the coverage of America.
Were you in it?
America.
I can't remember.
No, I wasn't. No,
were you asked to be in it?
Not... There was talk.
Yeah.
I think the... I think the producers were able to access interviews with me when they had just left the label.
Yeah.
And at the time I thought, fantastic, I'll be 10 years younger. And
20 years younger?
Oh, I don't know. When they just left the label
your label?
Yeah, my label.
I thought that was in the... Oh, was that only 10
years ago?
That was
about 2006 or something.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
I did not know that.
Or 2004 or something. Yeah, yeah. It was after General Electric.
Yeah.
There was an interview done with me by some people who were doing an early proposed doco, and that was being supplied to the producers, and I thought that might be in it. My only problem with the doco is it's sort of got into their personal lives when there was no need for it.
It's funny how, Case, that's an interesting perspective, because my take on that was I thought it got into their private lives and it was a very definite storytelling decision, but I didn't think it was exploitative or tacky, and I thought it felt to me, I mean, I can't speak for them, it felt like the four of them, you know what I'm saying? It felt like the four of them were willingly engaging in that, and the filmmakers basically didn't take the piss.
I just thought the things like sort of...
You just wanted to see all the rocking out and...
Yeah, but I... Yeah.
Did you feel like it felt like a little bit dirty laundry to you, whereas I'm saying it wasn't?
Well, it's just that there's definitely a sense in which John's relationship with his girlfriend, or his wife, girlfriend
his,
and wife.
His then, yeah, girlfriend, wife,
That sort of related to lyrics and stuff. But I think they then had to go into the other three to be equal.
Yeah.
And so Tom, you know, is talking about being unfaithful once. Well, you don't want that in there when you've got kids. Who gives a shit if someone's
Although
unfaithful
Although I thought
once?
The stuff about Phil was really honest, and I thought that could be a service to other people who drink too much. I thought him allowing that footage of him with the beer box on his head and stuff was like, you know...
But the truth is that he was driven to drink by psychological warfare from the other three members of the band.
Yeah, really?
That's the truth.
So you'll never get the full story in 90 minutes. I thought it was a pretty well done New Zealand music doco, but it's really interesting hearing from someone who was, you know, who was there. Backtracking a little, I mean, were you close to Gerald dying? Was that that must have kind of been a bit of a head.
That was a big shock. Gerald and I just... It was a funny working relationship because I'm the record company and he was the creative put it together of the records.
Yeah.
And he ran the tours and I did a very good job of PRing them. We used to make up stupid stories for New Zealand Truth and all that stuff.
Really? I didn't know you guys were doing that stuff.
Yeah,
was there Shi'ar tabloid fodder?
Yeah, or in the New Zealand Truth, it was just so stupid, some of the stuff.
What were they running about Shi'ar?
Well, at one point, it was mainly Head Like a Hole, but we'd make up stories.
I remember the Head Like a Hole ones,
There definitely was Shi'ar stuff, and even Dead Flowers, and we got everyone in.
Yeah.
And there'd be situations where, you know, lead singer on drugs, you know, for Dead Flowers. And it was just, he went and got some drugs for his throat for the tour,
Gerald,
you know. No, this is Dead Flowers, you know, this is just, you know, lead singer on drugs was just, you know,
him
Brian Bell getting drugs to strengthen his vocal cords, you know, to last the tour. And we had tons of... And at one point, I got to Wellington. I think I had the Festival Australia PR person with me, and we'd driven through the country. I'd shown her the tourist things. And we just bought the New Zealand Truth at where we filled up for petrol, and they had a double-page colour spread of Head Like a Hole, all these sort of naked photos, and or semi-naked and crazy photos, and it said, Head Like a Hole, make Spillane's look like the Morbid Tabernacle Choir. And at the time, like, the writer had said to me at the Truth, oh, look, we've just so overdone this, but the editor wants a double-page spread. And at the time, I thought, oh, I've just, you know, when I opened it up, I thought, oh, this is just...
Jump the shark.
Yeah, definitely. It's just like, I just feel dirty, you know, because I have put, you know, the band members, the parents, everyone through this. And then, so the next time at the Glue Pot, I'm pretty sure it's the Glue Pot, and I was used to going to the Glue Pot or those gigs and knowing every member of the audience, you know, other than I wouldn't know the younger generation. I wouldn't know the friends of the Pneumatics or whatever, but I would know the rock crowd. So Head Like a Hole, the gig is packed and I hardly know anyone.
So it's middle New Zealand's come out to see
it's
this
West
freak
Auckland,
show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's West Auckland and they just, you know, they just, well...
Great audience. They'd be the people who came back to the shows 20 years later recently.
Yeah, well, suddenly...
Did you go to the reunion? I went to the first one. I thought it was good.
I didn't go to that last one. I wanted to, but it was just before I went to the USA, so...
I've again made you turn a wee corner. I just touched on Gerald passing away, but... So that was a unexpected and strange thing.
It was just horrific, and sad, and it was it
an actual tragic rock and roll story rather than a truth.
It was one of those situations where, you know, I just went into spin mode and basically contacted Graham Reed at the Herald and said, can you make sure it's sort of done respectably at the Herald? Can you talk to the right person? So,
not do some awful
good coverage.
You know,
and I denied knowing the cause of death, which I strictly, well, I did know, but I mean,
you're not your place.
No, my attitude is the police tell you that. Ask the police. But, And I phoned Mike Houlihan at the Evening Post and told him. And, of course, Mike Houlihan wrote a half page on Head Like a Hole before I'd even signed them in the Evening Post. So so I contacted the writers that would do the story responsibly. And, of course, the Truth did it responsibly too.
Really?
You know, yeah. Because they all respected – well, they respected
Well, the way you spoke of the editors before, it sounds like even when they're doing those ridiculous titillation stories to sort of not-so-bright middle New Zealand, it sounds like the editors are in on the joke as well.
Well, I would never have met the editor. I mean, I knew that Edward Rooney was the writer, and then there was Neil Reed after then. But a lot of that stuff was just so much fun, those truth stories.
Oh, totally.
And the thing is, of course, when you go to the Glue Pot and you don't know anyone there, of course, I'm now in love with that centre.
Yeah. And Murray Kamek doesn't know anyone at the Glue Pot in the heyday of one of his bands. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, well, you're so used to it, just being the BFM crowd and the people you know and other bands.
Yeah.
And then, of course, Max TV came along in Auckland that was just fantastic for the Wildside bands. I mean, by that point, we were packing the power station, you know.
Is there any local bands lately that you think are pretty amazing? You still follow the local scene quite closely?
Not really,
closely?
No. I don't follow the local scene at all, other than, you know, the DJ
I saw
stuff.
A band called Yokozuna who I quite like. I'm sitting here a lot.
Well, see, I DJ with vinyl, so if they're not on vinyl, you know, I'm just playing Lady Six and Nathan Haynes and Lord Echo and...
Nothing wrong with that.
That's all.
Why are the DJ gigs drying up?
Oh, just people are tending to use a different DJ every week at a venue rather than have someone regularly in the one spot.
Yeah.
Which may be good in a way, but it's quite good if you can, you know what you played last week and play something different and, you know, whatever.
I think I saw you quoted somewhere saying once that you just stay where you are with what you like and then you just come in and out of fashion. Yeah. Something like that. Was that you?
That is totally true.
I really like that.
Just stay in the one place and the world will go round.
Yeah. Do you feel like that? I guess after that many years running the mag and stuff, I suppose you probably do feel like, that's come around again.
Yeah, well, to some extent, I think funk is there all the time.
Oh, totally.
Anyway,
especially in New Zealand.
And the dance music scene, you know, builds a healthy respect for the foundations of dance, you know.
I can do it at work now. I don't know if you know, in the last years I've been teaching, but I can do it with footwear. I can go, it's like rings on trees. It's like, Chuck Taylor's again.
Yeah.
Oh, Doc Martin's again.
It's true. I mean,
you know, it's like, okay.
And weirdly, I was very big on those sort of checkered shirts that were big, you know, about a year or two ago.
Yeah.
But I was big on those in the 80s and Rip It Up at some point.
And then they had another incarnation in the 90s with, who was it?
Grunge. Grunge.
But also Ice Cube and Friday wore them.
Oh.
And when I knew Moo many, many years ago, early on, he checkered shirt, Ice Cube from, there you go. Rings on a tree, stay in one place and you'll stay in fashion. The photography, it's an interesting part of your story because up until you did that exhibition of, I guess, kind of the Raiders of the Lost Queen Street arc or the car photos, I didn't know that was your kind of original passion. So talk a bit about that. You studied photography originally after school at Elam?
At Elam I went there and I think I was going to be, you know, the next McCann because he was religious too and
photographer version, though.
No, I was going to be a painter.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Do you paint?
Well,
obviously you do.
Well, I gave up after the first year at Elam because they were just, you know, I think they didn't like my born-again Christian thing and gave me either D or E in painting because my...
the religious overtones in your work.
Well, I think the nude drawing looked more like a McCann mountain, you know. And and I don't think I was that good anyway. I mean,
So how do you realize, shit, I can do this photography?
Well, what happened was in those days at Elam, it was a bit of a loose situation. So the sculpture lecturers were sort of there. The painting lecturers, if you do painting, you had to go look for them. The design lecturers would be upstairs doing their own commissions and own work. So the only people who were there 9 to 5 teaching were photography.
Yeah.
So about a third of senior students did photography, partly because John Turner and Tom Hutchins attended.
Right.
So, and they, their attitude was, well, if you're a Christian, you know, do something socially worthwhile, and Tenants Protection want a photographer to highlight the fact there's cockroaches in that apartment building, so can you do that tomorrow at 11 a.m.?
So you're doing kind of almost photojournalism-style stuff but via an art school. That's a really interesting combination because you're getting this aesthetic feedback, you're kind of capturing life
as well.
Yeah,
well, Tom Hutchins was a photojournalist in China after the Second World War. So photojournalism was definitely seen as part of the photography, the art of photography. So they let me take photos for Crackham, you know, Maori Land March and stuff like that, and I was sort of a Labour supporter, so I would take photos of Mike Moore for the Mount Eden electorate and Richard Preble for Auckland Central.
Yeah,
he's a Labour man.
Yeah.
And through that, I took some pretty amazing photos of things like the Nui Island fundraiser for Richard Preble.
I hope you've still got those somewhere.
Oh, shit, yeah.
And part of that would be getting into the room and developing, and so from snap to darkroom to developing.
Yeah, we had to do all that.
Yeah. And amongst that somewhere, your part-time hobby becomes looking quite buttoned down in the selfie I saw you taking, someone had taken of you, as they called it, one of the articles. You spot there's a car scene on Queen Street and start taking photos there.
Well, I started doing the photos of flash cars or Queen Street when I was in about the last year of Elam,
yeah,
or maybe second to last. And I kept going basically for about 10 years because after I went to a gig in, you know, Queen Street, or they're all near Queen Street, whether they were Main Street or...
So where are we, 77 to 87 or something?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. No, it'd be more like 75 to 81 or something, yeah. It's hard to date them exactly.
How do you do all that? Do you sleep a lot? It seems like you're running a magazine.
Yeah, but I did sleep a lot. In the magazine, like at one point we had three magazines, so Rip It Up didn't lose the money. The magazine that sort of lost the money was Shake or Cha Cha.
Yeah, yeah.
So we had three magazines, and so
you're finding time at night to get out and take photos.
Yeah, yeah. And the thing is, a lot of that time in the 70s, I didn't have a social life because I was a Christian, and
I thought there was great youth groups, camps.
Yeah, so I needed something to do Friday and Saturday night, so I went and took photos.
Does the church not have a vibrant social scene?
Well, the other issue was I'd worked out I was gay, see, so there's not a vibrant gay social scene.
But you don't have to tell them that. But you don't have to tell them that.
Well, anyway.
Yeah, it's an interesting combination. So 6 years, so what compels you to keep coming back to get these shots? What is it about... Is it just a love of cars, or is it the characters, or you know? I can understand any of it, but I can understand 6 months or whatever. But there must have been something really compelling for someone like you to do that for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, but remember the later years of that. I've maybe been to a gig at Main Street or Swines, and to walk home to my car, I'm walking past the cars.
Yeah,
you know. So the funny thing about that car exhibition was, the music people who came along said, oh, shit, we walked past all these to get to Swines, you know. And I talked to some women who were just totally into fashion and said, yeah, we had to walk past them just to go down Queen Street or go to a movie. You had to go after the movie. The cars would be there. So a lot of people almost would not have been interested in them, but when they saw the photos, they remember, oh, shit, they were lined up in Queen Street.
I love them. They're such a... all the obvious reasons I don't need to state, they're a snapshot in time in New Zealand when there wasn't, you know, I feel like for myself, you know, I feel like there's five photos of me growing up almost. What I'm meaning is there's a, you know, it wasn't common to have a lot of photos taken of a lot of single events or things like that back then. So I think that's amazing.
Well, everybody had such great stories. Even some people who grew up in Wellington, you know,
that's me, yeah.
Yeah, well, Louise Hunter was telling me that when she was a teenager, in one of those cars, you know, they went round the corner and she fell out the side, and she sort of had to explain to her mother the various bruises that she claimed she
I sort of like that about that era, though. Like, I remember I would have been, you know, I would have been 4 or 5 or whatever, and being in the front seat of a Kingswood that had, you know, those, what do you call them, bench seats, when you just had one big... So you've got one big long seat in the front, and I'm in the middle, and I'm 4, and so I'm basically a projectile if the car crashes. No seatbelt.
I know.
No seatbelt. I'm here. You know, I'm not saying we shouldn't have, but you sort of see kids now with sort of helmets strapped in. And
I'm totally into that. I'm totally into that.
Yeah.
But,
No, they're great. Yeah, they're great. And was it a matter of over the years, I wonder what happened to those, or did Simon Grigg find them and then it was sort of like, oh, wow, shit, we can exhibit these.
Oh, no, no.
Wasn't it a sort of Lost Scrolls kind of a scenario?
There was a situation where I got lost for a little while because of how to do it, you know, because I didn't want to do digital versions. But all that time when I was a bit lost about doing the exhibition, because once I became free of Rip It Up in 1998, I wanted to exhibit photos.
Yeah.
But it actually took me till 2014, I think, to do the first one in Australia. Or was it 2015? Yeah, it was 2015. But what happened in 2014 was, I think, Photo Forum had this big exhibition, and I had lent two lots of photos to people for possible publishing things. One had come back, and I knew there was one lot missing, and I was at the exhibition, and someone said, oh, that guy you may have lent them to is here. So I went over and said hello, and he said, oh, I've got a box in my, you know, in my storage unit with your name on it, but I think it's only got contacts in it. So he went and looked a few days later, and under the contacts were about, I think, 60 sheets of negative. And even the 60
strips.
Wasn't
Simon, it was someone
else. No, nothing to do. Yeah, no, it was another photographer. And the thing is, I viewed him as being very reliable, so I figured that he would have returned them, and this crowd I didn't know about were the problem. So I was on that day, I basically, and I didn't want them couriered, I just arranged to go to Wellington and, you know, get a cheap flight down and pick them up and fly back later in the day.
Carry back the briefcase.
There was just no barrier, so it happened within a year then.
And so how do you promote something like that in Australia? It's just good photography. I suppose there's a lot of expats over there.
No, well, look, there's a guy, George Hubbard, who was, he's an art curator, but he also managed MCO Jan Rhythm Slave, George Hubbard, and he did some really good exhibitions in Wellington in the late 80s. And he's always been a fan of my work, and he's one of his best quotes is, I love your work, it's you I can't stand, or something, to me.
That's a quotable, subquote. I've had a quote, a very quotable quote of someone quoting
like
someone
that,
else
but
on the podcast.
You just get the occasional email from him that just says something like that. Love your work, you're
a... So you can settle this for me as we go into the closing moments. This photography's so I try and avoid it, but I going down the wormhole of people discussing changes in audio and audio quality and yada yada and formats. So for me, it's photography is something I know far, far, far less about. What's your take on photography now and digital photography and taking photos with phones and what's good and what's bad?
Well,
and
I see fantastic photos with phones.
You know, they're pretty amazing.
Have friends who I'm trying to get a good photo on my good digital camera with.
She got an SLR.
Oh, well, no. I've actually only, like, my own one's a bit crap, but I borrowed one for this recent trip to America that is a good lens and stuff, but I don't like the SLR. I prefer the sort of the less bulky one.
Just point and shoot.
Yeah, point and shoot cameras.
So you take great photos.
Well, I
those.
Try to, but I mean, I just don't want the bulky thing hanging around my neck, which I used to have for so many years. You know, I just had that camera around my neck almost like a permanent thing for 20 years or so. But so I do like what people can do with digital and the phones, because you do. I mean, on Facebook or whatever, you'll have some, you know, band manager or musician or male model or someone just take amazing photos, and...
So you think the phone technology's caught up with no reason to have a point-and-shoot digital phone seems...
Well, it must be a bit like that. I mean, I had this really annoying thing happen in LA. A friend booked us on the tour of, I think it's called the Stahl House, that beautiful house that sits up on the Hollywood Hills, and there's a famous photo of the woman sitting with the lights of Hollywood behind, and you could use phones, mobiles, to take photos, but you weren't allowed to use cameras.
So I couldn't
take a photo.
So you couldn't.
No,
that's a sign of the times.
Yeah, well, the thing is, of course, those cameras would take as good a photo as well, maybe not.
But hang on, so there must be still a reason to carry around a very large lens SLR. Better selective focus, better zoom, better depth.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm an amateur here looking for some photography 101.
Yeah, well, definitely, like, those cameras, I just want to compromise where I can have a very good lens, which I've just borrowed one for this last trip.
Yeah.
But I don't want that bulk.
Yeah.
Mainly so that occasionally I can do the relatively discreet photos and stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I get
you
it.
Know, like... Yeah. I just don't want to have the big camera, no.
You get away with being a voyeur with the tiny...
Yeah,
it's
not sort of more voyeur, but it's more, you know, you're on the metro going through Compton and you don't want to attract too much attention to yourself.
No, I hear you, and you know what, even though some of your photos in the exhibition were people posing, it worked really well, but I know what you mean, like I far prefer even photos of myself if I'm having a good time or whatever that are candid than everyone stopping and going. But then, then there's also the thing of if you're trying to take photos of strangers, like, I get it. It's much easier just to be able to kind of...
Just sometimes just not to be having a big cumbersome camera. But in terms of mobile phones, during the late 70s when I was at... or mid-70s when I was at Elim, photographic books were coming out and they were costing about 50 cents or $1 or $2.
Photographic books?
Books, yeah, books of photographers like... Diane Arbus or Gary Winogrand or Brassai or all these fantastic photo books. So I was very inspired with my flash cars was to work towards a photo book, though that didn't happen. Now... one of the photo books that just blew my mind at the time was called Snapshot. And basically it was the concept that the intimate photo, the family photo, the snapshot is the ultimate in photographic achievement. And so to some extent, as a professional or art photographer or whatever, I was trying to be in Queen Street and be a little bit of a friend, but
Build up a rapport.
And achieve a snapshot, really,
Which you did. That's what I was saying before. I don't want you to get me wrong there. You did do that well, and they're not, definitely not sort of...
See that...
Did any of those people turn up at the exhibition?
Oh, shit, yeah. There was a lot there.
Did you remember
a
few of them? That's so cool. So that must have been pretty amazing.
Yeah,
right?
I'm in communication with, and it was a little bit stressful for me because, you know, like...
A lot of them still old petrol heads?
Well, yes, but, the thing is, they've got friends on the wall who are dead, you know.
Because
a lot of them are dead.
Yeah.
When you see someone a bit tearful in the corner, you're hoping no one's going to get angry with you or whatever. Though the people I know would never do that. But
Is that death just owing to age and so on, or was just is it through sort of semi kind of is there a criminal element and people dying young?
Well, there's
and all that
one
sort of
murder.
Thing as well.
There's one murder there, a gang related murder, which is very sad. And there's others who've just drunk too much. You know.
Yeah. Was that more of a thing then? I don't know.
Binge drinking's not new.
No, but I guess being able to have a box in your car is not really allowed that now.
But I do think there's a photographer I like, Stephen Shaw, who's done these great old Americana photos, and then so I look him up on YouTube, and he does this hour long dissertation on the intellectual, whatever importance of the frame and all this total bullshit about the intellectualization of photography. And then I think it was Gary Winogrand or someone say, you don't see and take the photo, you take the photo and see what you got.
well here we go full circle. Isn't that a great luxury of digital photography now? You can take 16 and pick one rather than going back and going, oh shit, I wasted all this time and resources.
In the old days we'd all, you know, often you'd take 36 shots and there was one good one on it.
So how's the radio going? Still doing radio?
Yeah, well, just Land of the Good Groove on BFM, and I do enjoy that occasionally. You know, you're having a busy Friday and you don't, but then sometimes when you've got a busy Friday and you've grabbed a few records in 5 minutes and plus a couple of new things you got 2 weeks ago and da-da-da-da, you do the best shows sometimes.
So you're still buying lots of vinyl?
Well, Yes, because like we're living in the time when the most vinyl ever has been available.
I'd imagine you'd have 10 times what I've got sitting here.
Well, I've got, maybe, but see...
Because I stopped quite a few years ago. I'm one or two pieces every now and again.
Well, I just went crazy about 5 years ago for about 3 years or something, because it's really hard for me in the sense there's so much more available.
You mean reissues or just secondhand stuff? Or
mainly fantastic reissues, and the fact that there's so much Northern Soul you can buy now when it used to be so hard to get.
And so that's interesting,
and
Murray.
There's so many regional scenes,
because your first, arguably not your first passion, that's music and photography, I'm sure, are pretty,
yeah,
but you've had a situation where you seem quite sort of loose and relaxed about the digital revolution with photography, but you're still very much an analog guy in a digital world when it comes to the music thing.
Yeah, but see, I'm mainly because I can DJ and I can see where I'm putting the needle, you know. I was quite happy with CDs until I started doing some DJing, and then, you know, I had to start rebuilding my vinyl,
No, there is, and there is something really lovely and tactile, like you say, not just being able to see where the tracks are, but it is,
like,
nice. It's even the rare occasion now, I actually, when you and I first sort of started to acquaint was when I think we were both doing Britomart Country
BCC,
Club a few years ago.
Yeah.
And I was sort of a combination of both. But even when I use the digital system, I still like to use the Serato that's got the vinyl, because it's what I've done for over 20 years. And just feels...
Yeah, well...
I still want to do that, even though it's a file.
Yeah.
I can't see, I'm doing the motion of putting a needle on a record,
yeah. Well, Serato, if it wasn't for Serato, I don't think there would be any vinyl turntables for me to DJ on, so you know what I mean, because there'd be no demand for...
Although some places now I've noticed have a strictly vinyl policy, like a lot of little bars around and stuff.
Yeah,
people like Patrick, like Dubhead, won't let it disappear, I'm sure. It feels like I could have you in every week for about the next 2 years and you'd have stories, but thanks so much for coming in and coming in later in the day. And we'll probably leave it there.
Yep, cool.
We'll get a nice photo of you.
Cool.
Put it on up.
How do you do that?